My name is Kara Lane Cape, and today we'll be interviewing Wallace Skip Grafton and Robert Ewald. We are at Mr. Grafton's home located in Louisville, Kentucky. It is October 2nd, 2012, and this interview with Mr. Grafton and Mr. Ewald is in regards to the history of the Department of Public Advocacy, as well as their involvements and experiences with the agency.
I came to start practicing law in Louisville in 1968. As a young lawyer just out of a JAG program, Air Force JAG, and got involved in the Louisville Bar Association. And I was sort of appalled at the situation as to how appointments were made to indigent defendants in our courts. And at that time, our court, physical system of our courts were a disaster. And we had a police court that was housed over in some corner of City Hall and a quarterly court, which was the county, that was up on the second floor of the physical court building. And it was bad, and juvenile court was worse. Mm-hmm. And people would walk down the halls in their first appearance in court, whether it was a felony or misdemeanor, in the police court, and they would be assaulted by lawyers over there who say, "You need a lawyer, son," and they'd all handle, "I'll plead you guilty for $50. And that stuff went on, and it was just awful. So at any rate,
I had forgotten about how bad it was.
It was awful. And I had worked in a sort of a pristine environment as an Air Force JAG officer, where everybody was represented by a lawyer, no matter how small their crime or whatever it was. So it was kind of shocking. Well, I became aware that a public defender statute had been introduced by Scott Miller and Ron Mazzoli in the 1970 General Assembly, and it passed the General Assembly and then was vetoed by Louis Nunn. And I talked to Scott Miller at the time and recently, and he told me a little bit about the story, but Scott understood how bad the system was here, and he was quite frustrated with Louis Nunn. So Jack Ballantyne, at that time, was president of the Louisville Bar Association. At that time, there had also been a big flare-up over the Legal Aid Society, and actually there was the appointments to and membership in the Legal Aid Society board resulted in a lawsuit in federal district court. Some people thought the Legal Aid Society was doing too much and robbing lawyers of all their duties and money, and other people thought it wasn't doing enough. And Judge Gordon wisely calmed the thing down and appointed a new board to the Legal Aid Society, and I ended up on that board. But anyway, as a result of all these problems, Jack Ballantyne appointed a committee for legal services to the poor, and I got put on that committee. What are we going to do about all this? Here's an unknown fact. A young lawyer named Walker Cunningham, who was a county attorney whose name appears nowhere in any of our documents, at a committee meeting said, "I know where there is federal money available to start a public defender program." And it was under a bill passed by Lyndon Johnson as a part of the Great Society called the Safe Streets Act. And that bill provided money mostly for police departments, for local and state police agencies, but also had a provision in it for public defender programs. And if you could apply for money from the Safe Streets Act, and you had to get matching local money. So we applied for a $250,000 or $300,000 grant under the Safe Streets Act, but we had to raise $50,000 of local money. And we did that, and we raised $10,000 from White, Grafton, and Sloss, and then we went to every other big law firm and said, "White, Grafton, and Sloss just gave $10,000. You need to do that too." And we raised $50,000 pretty quick. So now we had our money. That was in the summer and fall of 1971, and we actually then filed our articles of incorporation in the fall of that year. Now comes the problem of, wow, we got all this, what we thought was a lot of money.
And at that time, it was a lot of money.
Who are we going to get to run this program? And because there was a lot of animosity toward our program. There were lawyers in town who thought, you know, the police court hangers on, these guys are going to take all our clients. So we started this nationwide search. It occurred to me, having just come out of the JAG, that if we could find a retiring JAG officer, that person would really be a good idea of somebody we might find. And so I wrote and I called to some friends of mine who were still in the JAG, and were in Washington at JAG headquarters, and I called the Air Force, a guy in the Air Force and a guy in the Army, and I got two names in. And one of the names was just this blank envelope that I received that had Paul Tobin's resume in it. It wasn't signed. There was no letter from Paul Tobin. It was just this envelope that apparently someone in the JAG sent to me. This is the guy you ought to look at. So I wrote Paul Tobin, who was still on active duty at that time, and he was just about to retire. And he called me back very interested, and he came to Louisville on a very cold, clammy, wet, awful day in December of 1971. And we hit it off, and I hired him, and he was perfect. I mean, he brought an air of dignity. He brought an air of respect to this program.
And an air of dominance, too. I mean, nobody messed with Paul Tobin.
Oh, that's right. He was Colonel Tobin.
Yeah, he was Colonel Tobin, and nobody messed with him. He was perfect.
And he brought an air of to the program, although we hired a lot of young lawyers, had to, an air among them of pride, and he just brought all this stuff to this program. So Paul went out and hired six young lawyers, and, you know, I've got to, we have to fill this in later. Jeff Morris.
Mm-hmm. I didn't realize Jeff was one of the
first. He was one of the first six.
Circuit judge now.
Yeah, he's now, you know, retired circuit judge.
Is he retired?
Yeah. He's a,
I see him at church.
He's a senior judge. And I've got to go back, and I tried to call Jeff yesterday and couldn't get a hold of him and find the names of the others. A guy named Sandy Taft, I know, was there. I told Paul, we've got to get an African-American lawyer. We've got to have one black face in that office. And we did. He found somebody, I'm trying to think of that guy's name before it's over. Maybe I will. Anyway, so Paul started with six young lawyers and set up an office in, what was that awful old building?
I've forgotten.
On the 10th floor of the building at 5th and Walnut, 5th and Muhammad Ali now, a crummy place. One day I took the mayor up there because we were begging for money, and Harvey Sloan, and all the elevators in the building were out of order, and we had to walk up 10 floors to his office. But anyway, Paul started in that office there. Now, the doors opened on July 1, 1972, right?
Okay.
And we started our program. Now, Wallace can tell you about how the statute got passed at Wendell Ford Science.
Before we move there, you mentioned Jack Ballantyne. What was his position?
He was president of the Louisville Bar Association at that time, and he was the one who started this committee. And he put Walker Cunningham on this committee. He put me on the committee, some other people. Actually, the other people on that committee were a lot of the people who were the original directors of the Louisville Public Defender. But Walker Cunningham, who was an assistant county attorney, was actually the guy who came up with the idea of getting this federal money. We had no idea where we were going to get any money when we started.
Well, going back to my experience with it, let me say, I was an original Wendell Ford supporter. There were, I think, five of us in Jefferson County out of the mob. This was Burke Holmes' territory. And in his lieutenant governor's campaign, I got to meet a young lawyer named Larry Greathouse, who came out of Appleret, Apple Regional Development, whatever, I've forgotten.
Appalachian Research.
That's fine. Some people, Louis Nunn, thought were communists. And I was on the corporate side. Bob was a trial lawyer. I tried a case, and I was sick for weeks. It was not my cup of tea. So I was on the corporate side of the law firm, and Larry Greathouse asked me if I would help him he represented and did a lot of work with poverty agencies in eastern Kentucky who were under attack from Louis Nunn. And I went down and helped represent and did represent Clay County, Jackson County, a whole bunch of the eastern Kentucky counties in their fight with Louis Nunn over funding. And in eastern Kentucky, the issue was political control, because in eastern Kentucky, the county judges were basically family operations. They controlled the school board in these counties, and the poverty agency was a challenge to that political power because they had jobs and patronage, and so there was a war going on, and that's how I got involved on the poverty side and got to be really good friends with Larry Greathouse. And then I was very active in the Wendell Ford campaign for governor, and we did very well, it turned out, and we carried Jefferson County by the largest majority of gubernatorial candidate ever carried the county, which came as a great shock to everybody. But when Ford became governor, he asked me to come up and be a legislative assistant to him. And Larry Greathouse came as general counsel to Wendell Ford. And I don't know, the public defender, to my knowledge, had not been an issue in the campaign for governor. And I don't quite know how it became up in the governor, but in those days, the governor was the government. The legislature did whatever the governor. There were three types of bills in the legislature. A bill the governor supported, it passed. A bill the governor was neutral on, he didn't give a damn one way or the other. And then bills that governor opposed, they did not pass. Governors were almost dictators in those days. I mean, they used their patronage, and I saw some evidence, and Wendell Ford was a real pro at that. I mean, he really understood the power of the legislature. But sometime early in January, I was called to a meeting with Larry Greathouse, and Ford said, and my guess is that the pressure on Ford, or not pressure, but conversations came from two. One, he was familiar because he was lieutenant governor when the bill passed the first time, so he knew something about the issue. In those days, the lieutenant governor was president of the Senate. I mean, he actually sat and presided over the Senate. So Ford had some knowledge. But my guess is that the pressure really was, urge was for funding, because you had the need to fund these cases. There were relatively few lawyers willing to take these cases for free. And in counties like Jefferson, you had a real problem. And it's my guess, I don't know this for sure, that Chief Justice Palmore talked to Morton Holbrook. Morton Holbrook was Wendell Ford's legal confidant, if you want to call it. And in any event, Ford said that he would like to see, and the reason he was interested, in addition to which, it was a funding issue. There was plenty of support in the legislature, but it was a funding issue. And so Don Bradshaw, I was instructed, along with Larry Greathouse, to work with Don Bradshaw on getting funding. And about this time, Bob came along and said, you know, we need to get a law that allows us to get funding for the corporation, because it really, the effort previously, or at least to my knowledge, was more individual, to provide court funding to the courts to be able to pay public defenders.
And we only had, our grant was only for 2 years.
Okay.
After 2 years, we were going to run out of money.
But I think, weren't we the only corporation in Kentucky?
Well, yeah, we were the first.
Okay, so we wanted to make sure whatever legislation got passed allowed funding to the corporation. And Bill Kenton in the House and Senator Graves in from Lexington, I'm trying to think of who else. Oh, the majority leader, Mike Swinford, got the bill. It was supported by the governor, and we all worked together with the LRC to get it in a form that was acceptable. Bob reviewed it and told us it would do the trick. And once Ford said, it's my bill, it was gone. I mean, it was passed. I didn't have to do a thing. It just, Max Swinford, who was majority leader in the House, made sure that it got the votes to go through. And in the Senate, Graves was a Republican, but Scott Miller was very much for it. It had no opposition, basically. I mean, there might have been some votes against it in one house or the other, but I mean, there was never any doubt. And it passed easily, and Ford signed it, and it was funded. I've forgotten to what level, but it was funded. And that was it. As I said, Bob was the father. I was just a midwife in there, kind of pushing along wherever Bob thought it needed to be pushed. So that's kind of how it went through the legislature.
Were either of the two of you involved with the five names that came from the Kentucky Bar Association?
No. Don't know how those names came from or where they came from. Like I said, right at that point in time, I was working through and with the Louisville Bar Association to establish the Louisville program. And I was thrilled that there was now money to continue our program thereafter, but we had at that point set up our Louisville program. We were working on getting it running, getting it going, and I wasn't involved with what went on in Frankfort in order to get the Kentucky program set up. But as years went by, of course, I became more and more involved with it, more and more aware of it, and eventually got on the, on the board.
And was Ed Logan involved with this?
Not to my knowledge. Frankly, I've never had any contact with the Kentucky Bar Association at all.
What wasn't Ed Assistant General Counsel?
Might have been. I remember Ed, yes, from Frankfort, yes.
Was he involved in any of your...
I'm assuming with Larry Greathouse. I never was close to Ed. Larry Greathouse and I had rented an apartment together and were great friends from poverty days, so that was where I worked.
Wendell Ford gave two very important speeches about the public defender program in that early year. Did either of the two of you have any involvement with writing those? Or?
Didn't write them. The one he gave in the Louisville office is the one I'm thinking about, and I was there. But no, I didn't assist him in writing it in any way. Don't know who did.
And I'd returned to the private practice by then.
So that's the story of the start.
Legal Aid Society kind of existed in a slum, and it looked like a slum. If you went into it, you had no confidence. The other guys were being represented by guys in suits and in big established offices, and then you went and got a lawyer out of this kind of slum. I mean, it was just awful. Colonel Tobin immediately realized, so as quickly as he could, he got us into an office. Now, it was not the Taj Mahal, but it was clean. It had decent furniture. It was organized. I mean, there were places for files and stuff. So when you went into the public defender, you had confidence that you had competent counsel and that really worked for you. And I always consider that a major move.
But the other thing about Legal Aid, and I was on the board of Legal Aid too, because I got on that board, but the guy that led Legal Aid, these were the days of the hippies, and all that. And the Legal Aid lawyers all kind of wore plaid shirts and ties that didn't match. Tobin's boys wore, and women too, he had some women pretty early on, but they wore nice suits. I mean, there was an obvious difference between the Legal Aid lawyers. Not that they weren't good. It's just kind of the way they deported themselves, and the public defenders were, they were kind of looked Ivy League and preppy.
Yeah. It was the military. Colonel Tobin carried his rank right on into it.
How did Dan Goyette come to be hired?
Dan Goyette started out in the program, and Paul Tobin hired him as just one of the staff lawyers. And then, I always kid Dan, because Dan went to the dark side for a while. He went over and worked for the Commonwealth Attorney for a couple of years, and then Paul hired him back from the public. At this point, Paul realized that he was, looking toward his retirement. And Paul hired Dan back and groomed Dan to take over. I mean, 2 years before Paul retired, he and I talked about his retirement, and he said, look, I think Dan Goyette is the guy. And so Paul brought Dan along with the idea that, Dan was going to take over the job, and Paul pretty much set that. We were happy to go along with it because, Dan looked like a good, sharp, bright young guy to us, and of course he was, and he's done everything that we hoped he would do. But that's really There's not much to that story because that was Paul's doing, and the board was happy to go along with him on that. So that's the story of how we got started. Now, as we continued, then we came off of, we had a 2-year funding from this federal program. And then, of course, at the end of that 2 years, we had to start getting our money from the state program. And of course, when we wrote that statute, when we formed the Public Defender Corporation, we did get some money from Jefferson County originally. The city of Louisville had promised us money, and they never gave us any. And I was mad at that guy. It was Frank Burke was mayor then, and I was mad at his assistant who promised us money and then he never came through with us. But we got our matching funds. But we wanted a board to run that corporation that was free of political influence. That was one of the things we were worried about. We didn't want any politician or Commonwealth attorney or anybody else telling us how we ought to defend our clients and how we ought to handle our office. And of course, Paul Tobin was the perfect person who was going to tell him what to do. You know, and so he was the perfect guy. And that's one of the reasons I was looking for a JAG officer, and I got so lucky to find this guy. But that was the purpose. And when we worked on that statute, our purpose was that way also. We want to be very careful to have a public defender that was, you know, as free from political influence as we possibly could make it. And, you know, the statute has been amended and so forth over the years, but we've always been as careful as we possibly could to create a public defender program that was free from political influence. And I'll tell you a story if you want to hear it. And this, I'm digressing a minute, but there was a time when a particular legislator, who was a chairman of a committee, decided that one of our Jefferson County public defenders was out of line, and in a committee meeting, he convinced the committee that was true, and the committee, and this was not when the legislature was in session, it was when they had one of their off-session meetings, and they issued a demand that Dan Goyette fire this young woman because she had been out of line. Well, fortunately, the incident where she had allegedly been out of line was at a CLE seminar that she helped teach, and we had videotaped it. And so we invited this legislator to our office and played the video to my office and played the videotape for him. And of course, the videotape proved quite conclusively that she hadn't done anything wrong at all. And so this legislator was, you know, obviously knew he was wrong, but he finally looked at us and he said, "Well," he said, "you know, do your public defenders really have to try so hard?" And I looked at him and I said, "The only thing that would cause me, under circumstances like this, to think that we should ever fire a public defender was if they didn't try hard enough." So, and we kind of, Dan and I kind of at this point threw him out of our office and we never heard from him again. But I think that's the one point where that I remember in all the years of the public defender where a legislator was bold enough to try to do something like that. So fortunately, maybe you had some situations like that, but we've been able to resist it. Unfortunately, we had that videotape of this idiot.
Yeah, my one blowback experience didn't deal with the public defender at all, but it dealt with Louis Nunn. Louis Nunn took it very personal with the, by the way, we won all the poverty cases, not only in the state courts, but he tried to defund us at the federal level, and we took appeals to the Atlanta regional office and won all those cases. And the irony of it all is that it was they were forced to pay us a legal fee. But Louis Nunn never forgot that. And many years later, he was on the board. I've forgotten whether it was Moorhead or Eastern. And I was bond counsel. We were doing a bond issue to float. And it came time at the board meeting to pass the resolution. As bond counsel, we have resolutions that are 28 pages long, whereases and now therefores. And I stood up and said, this is the resolution we need to have passed. And Louie Nunn said, why should we pass this? And I said, well, because it's needed to do the bond issue. He said, well, I don't think we should pass this. And I said, well, I'm not going to give my opinion that this is a valid bond issue if you don't pass it. And we had a stalemate. And he said, well, I'm not going to pass it. I said, fine. I packed my bag and started out of the room. Well, Ned Breathitt was on the board, too. I forgot. There must have been a university in some trouble because there was Breathitt was on the board, Nunn was on the board.
Kentucky State University.
Okay, maybe that's what it was. And anyway, Breathitt intervened, and finally, Louie Nunn voted for the resolution. But he told me, I'll get you, you son of a bitch. Fine. Keep after it, Governor. But it got kind of personal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Did you all have any knowledge of his veto message?
No. I think it came as a surprise to everybody.
What, the original veto?
The original veto.
Well, you know, Scott, in your sometime probably I interview Scott Miller.
Who's a great guy, too.
Who is a great guy. And Scott must be well into his 80s, but he's still sharp as a tack. And it was Scott and Ron Mazzoli. Of course, Scott told me, I didn't know Ron Mazzoli had been involved in it. Scott told me that it was Ron Mazzoli in the House and he in the Senate who pushed this thing through. And then at some point, Louie Nunn told Scott to come over because Louie Nunn was going to sign another bill that Scott had worked through the Senate. And when Scott got over there and then Louie signed the one bill and then Louie also signed the veto bill, just to embarrass Scott.
But
you're going to have to ask Scott about that because I won't retell his feelings toward Louie Nunn.
we will go interview.
Yeah, it's worth it. I think Scott's a charming guy and you might talk to him about
it. Scott had a really good relationship with Wendell Ford, too. Wendell Ford appointed Scott eventually to the board of the University of Louisville. When I was on the board and when I was chairman, Scott was vice chairman and succeeded me. So Scott, by the way, defeated my father for the state senate. My father had been the state senator for Eastern, well, in that time, all of Jefferson County outside the city of Louisville, and Scott beat him in the so-called Black Tuesday of 1956 when Earl Clements went down to defeat. My father got beaten. But they were great friends. Okay?
Tell us what involvement you had with the KBA over the years.
Well, I was, involved with the Louisville Bar Association, and I was on the board at one time, and I was also the chair of the Louisville Bar Foundation, and we raised the first $1 million. Bob Dahl and Larry Franklin and I, we were the first three presidents of the Louisville Bar Foundation, and we raised the first $1 million. I didn't get too involved with the KBA. I was on some committees, but didn't chair anything until the attorney advertising thing came up. And when the first Supreme Court case on attorney advertising came up and all the states realized that they better have some regulations, I was asked to serve on the Attorney Advertising Commission by the KBA. There were three members on that commission, and there were, attorney advertising rules set up, and that was, I'd have to go back
sometime.
In the 80s, in the mid-80s, and I served on that commission for like 12 or 14 years, something like that. But that was really kind of my first involvement in the KBA, and serious involvement where I was, working on chairing a board. I, at one point, served as chair of that. We just played round robin with that. Then I got active in some other KBA committees. And then at some point, and Ed, you were involved in this, that I went on the on your board. Dan came and talked to me about going on that. At this point, there were a lot of problems with leadership. And we were getting into fusses about how much funding there was going to be for Louisville. And with Paul Isaacs, that was when Paul was
was the public defender, wasn't it, when I came on originally? And the chair of the Public Advocacy Commission was a fellow from Northern Kentucky.
Bill Johnson?
Yeah. Who was a strong fellow himself. It was an interesting group up there, but that's when I came on, about that time, came on the Public Advocacy Commission. But my involvement with the KBA had not been up until I got on the Advertising Commission had not been real active. I was more active in the Local Bar Association.
Now, I was saying Bob's defense, it was not without some cost that Bob's involvement at the KBA level on advertising, because internally in a large law firm, Bob was constantly having to send little memos to people about, you can do this, you can't do that, and it, excuse the language, pissed people off. And it was not without some, I don't think there were any longstanding grudges or anything, but there is a cost to going to war with your partners, one or more, particularly on the trial side, us corporate lawyers kind of stand out of it, but... And Bob persevered through it all to the point where finally, I think everybody came, before they did anything, came to Bob and said, what do we do?
Well, here I am on the board, and so my firm has got to toe the line. We've got to obey the rules. And nobody understood what the rules were to begin with. There was no understanding at all.
Didn't want to know.
And no, they didn't want to be bothered with that. And so I'd see somebody do something stupid, and I'd have to say, no, you can't really do that. And it took a while to educate people.
So, I think people tend to think of it, well, you know, he was up there, and there are hardships to it or consequences to it.
Were there any costs to the two of you being supportive of the creation of the Public Defender Program?
No.
No, let me tell you something. We had a leader, Wilson Wyatt.
Wyatt, that's right.
Who encouraged everybody in our firm to get involved in community activities and bar association activities. I remember, now this is really off public defender thing, but I threatened to sue, to bring a class action against an insurance company that was headquartered in Indiana, and it would have been an interesting class action. And my little old client was only owed about $1,500 by this company, but I wrote a letter to them and told them that if they didn't pay me, I thought I had a pretty good class action here. Well, the former governor of Indiana, who apparently was on the board of this insurance company, called his old political ally, Wilson Wyatt, and said, what is this young lawyer of yours down there doing? And Wilson Wyatt walked into my office, and he said, what's this about you bringing a class action against so-and-so? And I told him about it, and he said, hmm. He said, go get him. And he walked out of the office.
Yeah, Wilson really was big on... I think took a great deal of pride in what Bob had done, because Wilson really thought lawyers owed an obligation to be involved, and that was very public.
I mean, Wilson was the first. Wilson said, it is a rule that all associates in our office will put at least 50 hours of pro bono work a year. They must do that. And so, yeah, he was... You got to be involved in the community.
Why this area?
Huh?
Why did you choose to do this area?
Oh, it just happened. I mean, here I was as a young lawyer looking at what I thought was an awful situation. And all of this kind of came up, and I was kind of in the middle of it. So, you know, it just...
I'm a follower.
Kind of drifted.
Bob led, and I just kind of tagged along. He got me involved in it, and I follow along. But it's really hard for people today to understand how bad the system was, at least in Jefferson County. I mean, it was incredibly corrupt at the police court, county court level. It was in the grubbiest, dingiest places. Lawyers hung out, handing out cards. It was incredibly bad. Now, I didn't see that much of it because I was on the corporate side, but what I did see, and Bob saw it really firsthand. I mean, it was really bad. Now you look at it and you say, well, I don't understand what the big problem was. Well, there's been a monumental change in Jefferson County.
The first volunteer thing I ever did that the Louisville Bar Association, I was put on the committee that was supposed to represent people who were being committed. What did we call it?
It's county court.
Yeah, but
mental inquest.
The mental inquest committee, that was it.
Oh, God.
So they took these young, that's why every young lawyer was put on the mental inquest. So you would rotate and each, oh, God, it was awful. Every other week, they would bring a whole busload of people in from Central State, which we always called Lakeland.
It was really bad.
They'd bring them in a bus and parade them up to one of the courtrooms and just, you know, just go down the line and declare them all incompetent. And you have one lawyer appointed to represent 25 or 30 people in these incompetency hearings. These people, most of them didn't know where they were or anything. Well, I took it very seriously. I went out and interviewed every damn one of them to see whether or not I really thought they were incompetent and whether, you know, what should happen to them. And once or twice I got, not often, but once or twice I thought got somebody I thought was being railroaded. And I put up a defense. I usually win, too. I mean, it didn't take much, but I mean, these people just got brought down in this bus and railroaded through this thing. So this is the kind of stuff that was going on. It was awful. It was really bad. And the police court wasn't any better. But that mental inquest was just terrible.
And Bob, you represented public defenders through the years when they were had show cause orders.
Yeah.
Why they should not be held in contempt. Can you talk a little bit about that and why you did that and what that was about? And
well, I did it because I just felt it was, I mean, I was close to the public defender program and Dan or Paul would call me and it was always about, it never failed to be about, some judge over there getting unhappy because the poor public defender was supposed to be in three courtrooms at the same time and he showed up 5 minutes late for Judge A because Judge B had put him at the bottom of the docket and it delayed him in that courtroom and he didn't get up to courtroom C until 9:40 when the criminal docket was being called at 9:30. That was always what happened. And you just have to go over and say, well, Judge, we're really sorry about this and we'll try not to make it happen again. And then that happened, you know, then we go over the whole judge's matter. We go over to the chief judge and try to, you know, make him understand it. I don't ever think we had, that I can ever remember, a serious issue about in Jefferson County about a lawyer's misconduct. It was always about him being late because he was down in another courtroom. The more interesting thing was, in that regard, and this is the only thing that ever any money I ever got about out of the whole deal. When there was a point in time when out at LaGrange and Eddyville, they suddenly got the idea that they could bring a suit in federal court for malpractice. You know, they'd exhaust every other conceivable appeal. Then they decided they'd sue their lawyer for malpractice, and there was some courtroom, I mean, some jailhouse lawyer, at LaGrange, that got pretty good at writing these malpractice complaints. So there was a series of those filed out in federal court. And after about six or eight of them all got dismissed pretty quickly, they kind of gave up on that. But I did represent the insurance company and did get paid something for handling those cases. None of them ever amounted to anything. And finally, these guys realized that they gave up on it, and they stopped filing those.
In 1990, you were on the Public Advocacy Commission, and the Public Advocacy Commission had formally adopted in 1990 a goal of creating a full-time public defender program across the state. Can you tell us about that?
I think that was the most important thing I'd ever did while I was on the commission. And Ernie was involved in that, and I think that was right. Wasn't that right when we appointed Ernie, or he was appointed?
He was in 96, so this was in 90.
Okay, well,
but Ernie was involved with bringing the recommendation.
Yeah. I know. I talked to Ernie about it, and it seemed to me that the system we had in many counties. I mean, I was familiar with how Jefferson County worked. We had a full-time program here, full-time lawyers, and the system was working reasonably well. But out in the state, of course, they had these contract lawyers. So if somebody got accused of, needed a public defender in Callaway County or some small county somewhere, and what I said Callaway, but some small county, there would be a lawyer on contract out there to represent them. And that system, to me, was not working very well. And it seemed to me that the only way to really have an effective public defender system was to have a statewide full-time system. And so I know I talked to Ernie frequently about it, and I talked to Dan about it and other people. But it seemed to me that if we were going to have a really, really good public defender system in Kentucky, that had to be our goal, to get a statewide system. And we ultimately did. And Ernie was very adamant about that, too. Ernie felt the same way. And I just remember talking to Ernie on numerous occasions about that. But when Ernie came in as public advocate, the public advocate, that was his goal, too. But we had talked about that before he came in, and it was really through Ernie that it really, and you and others, that it really became, it really worked, and we really got it done.
You were chair of the Public Advocacy Commission for many years. Any memories about that you'd want to?
No, not anything particular. I was chair, and I still am on the commission. It's a very rewarding thing to see this program work, and from the very beginning to see it take shape and to feel like you had something to do with it, although not really very much. Just in essence, I was really just a cheerleader. But to have something to do with it and be involved in seeing the program become successful, and then the constant frustrations of any program like this in every state in the country is adequate funding. And so that's always been the theme from the very first day, was doing the battle of getting adequate funding for the program.
Both of you are key people to the creation and the development of the Public Defender Program in Kentucky. When you look backwards at your roles, what are you most proud of? What value do you say I'm glad I was involved with?
Well, you know what? Everything I know is that despite our constant battle for funding, we have an outstanding program. And I've been on a lot of American Bar Association programs, and I've worked with bar presidents from other states, and of course the one I think of now is Louisiana, one of their past bar presidents is the equivalent of the chair of their commission, and see the problems that they have and realize that we really do have a good system in Kentucky that we can be proud of. And that's the thing that really is the thing I think about most, that we really have developed a good system.
And I agree with that. That's, I think as you get older, you look back and say, what have I accomplished or left? And, that's something that I give Bob all the credit, but I feel some part of the contribution of something that has lasting benefit to people. And that's a great sense of satisfaction. And pride.
One of the other things on the protection and advocacy in 77, when that, do you know Jack Andrews? Jack Andrews, and
a VMI graduate, I might add.
Huh?
A VMI graduate. I say that with some reluctance.
No, Jack's a nice guy, but anyway, Jack was worked for Marlo Cook, when Marlo Cook was in the Senate. And Marlo Cook was one of the sponsors of the bill, the federal legislation on protection and advocacy. And Jack worked on the writing of that legislation. And I didn't know about that until I talked to, not too long ago, talked to Jack about that. But he had been involved in that legislation and was that's one of the things he's very proud of when he was working in Washington for Marlo Cook, about having a hand in bringing about that legislation. That's just a little interesting tidbit.
Other things about our timeline or our history that you could add to the public record?
I think that recently the relationship between the public defender and the Kentucky Bar Association has really improved. And I think, you know, when it started, before I was president and officer, Dick Clay came and spoke. Wasn't he the first bar president to come and speak?
I think so.
Dick Clay came and spoke.
Very substantive talk.
Yes, it was a very good talk, very thoughtful. And I think that that kind of started improving the relationship with the Kentucky Bar Association. Of course, now we have a very good relationship, and it's going to continue when you look at who's vice president now, certainly in the immediate future, and certainly Doug Myers is a supporter. And so I think that's a very important relationship that I've had something to do with in recent years, which will improve things.